Good evening. It's really a pleasure to be here in conversation with Taye Selassie, Achille Mbembe, and Bernd Shearer. And I want to thank HKVA for inviting us and putting this together. Politics today is nothing short of civil war. States descend into civil wars when contrasting conceptions of life within them are deemed irreconcilable. Living for a considerable proportion of the state's inhabitants is made unbearable. Those at least nominally controlling the state apparatus insist on obedience and deference to its way of being, on pain of erasure for refusal or resistance. Where governance is substituting for institutional politics, civil wars are struggles over competing ways of being in the world. To continue the trope of hoods, this piece, you probably can't see the title, is called The Tale of Two Hoods. They are struggles over their underlying conceptions and over control of the state and its apparatuses to materialize and advance these commitments. At the outset and in the end, civil wars are not foremost about resorting to arms, even as they may quickly gear up to blows. For the struggle to be considered blowworthy, the contrast must be palpable and pressing. The commitments animating civil war that constitutes the political today are forced appeals to contrasting sets of commitments. I will call these oppositional contrasts, riffing off A.L. Weitzman, the conceptual conflict shoreline. These contrasts include appeals, and I'm going to scroll down a set of contrasts and just talk to them. At the end of this, you'll have a moment to sort of read through them as I'm talking. So you'll notice that on your left, my right, are a set of conceptions, that is to the right or your left of the disjunction, are a set of conceptions that animate closed societies, enclosures, ways of closing down, ways of refusing access, ways of refusing entrance. On the other side of that disjunction are commitments to openness, to engagement, to heterogeneities, to looking after rather than keeping out. There are obviously more nuanced, lived and negotiated between and multifold states than these broad contrasts. But the broader and more fixed the contrast, the more uncompromising the commitment to a single side, the more readily one can characterize this as civil, or really incivil, social warring. The force is one-sided in a doubled sense. One-sided in forcing one's commitments onto those uninterested in, even indifferent to, disagreeing with, and especially resisting them. But one-sided in the even more pressed sense that the force is almost invariably the product of the homogenizing commitment. It is the inevitable effect of the fixation on curtailed homogeneity, on authority, the compulsion in make-believe, command, contempt, fixity, perhaps even self-recursively on fixation itself, and on its conditions, of course, of reproduction. So the struggle, in short, comes down to that between manipulated control at any and all cost and to co-constitutive interactive engagement. Civil struggles that blow up into full-fledged wars, whether conceptually or materially, culturally or politico-economically, require of people to declare their commitments. We are encouraged, if not forced, to take sides. This is demanded of both members of the society and distant observers. Even neutrality in the face of impending death and destruction in the final analysis is itself side-taking. It should also be obvious that racialities mark all of the warring contrasts listed here. Racialities help both to shape and sharpen them. Race reflects and animates, at least partly constitutes and exacerbates these conditions. Those identified with the latter items in each of the pairings, those to your right, my left, accountability, constitutionality, responsibility, respect, dignity, the evidential, etc., will be equated with, if not straightforwardly, as racially other. They will be marked as minoritarian to some other degree, as past or romanticized failed states. They will be taken to be aligned with or maligned as the racially or ethno-racially distinct. They will be equated with or as the non-belonging, literally with or as the not white, the black. Even their wayward supporters, those otherwise presumed white, ethno-racially, will be treated by equation with the less than, no matter the amount of trying, never quite white. Why even bother trying? Why even or ever the question? Race, then, is the cement in the architecture of modern sociality. It is a prompt and product of social warring, its medium and outcome. It is a deeply relational condition. Racism anywhere is sustained, indeed is sustainable, only by racisms elsewhere. You might say by racisms more or less everywhere. It is violence in the waiting, in the making, offense and defense, embodied and enacted. So John Coetzee's observation about late apartheid South Africa applies generally today. And so this is a quote from Coetzee's Summertime, the third in his trilogy of quasi-memoirs, right? And I'll just let you read through this as I go on. A civil war, then, immediately draws a sharp line, the line in the sand. On one side are those claiming to be or to assume the side of the state as status quo, of law and order, no matter how unjust. On the other are those for whom the powers and social arrangements the state represents fall critically short, and in defense of which the state resorts to repressive violence. Those outside the territorial line, those marked for and by preclusion, more often than not are those characterized as unbelonging and undeserving. They would be cast out as outsiders within. They are tarred with the brush of racial difference. As Coetzee's insight reveals, the state, in South Africa's case, but the point is that apartheid South Africa was an extension of European reach, of the global north more generally, is white and Christian by design, descent, and legacy. Excuse me. So it's interesting how the possibility of wearing this T-shirt boldly has become subject to no criticism at all. One can walk around. I mean, it's not just the white Catholic Europe. It's white Catholic Europe sustained by uniform and AK-47 or automatic rifle and so on. There's a way in which racism today is no longer tethered to a kind of set of state categories or categorizations, right? It can be done boldly, in your face, without any remorse whatsoever. Even secularized states embed the history, the defining features, the traditions, the commitments, the ways of being and seeing in the world of white Christianity, of Christian whiteness. And this is, you know, all know Bill O'Reilly from the O'Reilly Fact on Fox News, who now has just been kicked out. But these are statements by him in the last year or two representing exactly this kind of this set of commitments. Reinventions of religiosities, first elaborations, then remainders of race. Race, I am suggesting, is the secularization of the religious. Religious wars historically marking the European landscape today are nothing short of race wars internalized. About self-proclaimed origin narratives, about make-believe kinship, not so long ago explicitly called blood, about the landscape and its ownership, about access and privilege, about control and its subjects or subjections over resources and decision-making, and truth claims and facts and evidence, about cultural legacy and its parental provenance, which is to say about its heritage, but also its proper inheritance, its rightful heirs in whose name the culture will supposedly live on as defining traces, even while being remade. At its core, about the right to be, to belong, the intersecting and interacting epistemological and ontological powers of determination and self-determination. The line keeping outsiders out works in terms of the racial determination of immigration and the technologies of bordering, about which I think Ashil will talk. In Europe's case, these racial determinations reach across the lines of the historical and contemporary. Jews, Muslims, Arabs, Blacks, Roma, Asians, and South Asians, in a way, the very constitutive outsiders of Europe making from the 1450s onwards. The line marking insiders as not fully belonging is inscribed in terms of differentiations in blood, bones, and behavior, culture and character, projected incapacity, and lack of intelligence. The preclusions are enacted in the name of maintaining historical homogeneity in the face of its undoing. But the maintenance, first of the fantasy of differentiated being and capacity, and then of its enactment, is possible only by the compulsions of make-believe. This conservation requires forced and forced constraint, the making in make-believe, the compulsion of thought and deed, of compelled movement and sedentarism, of being sedentary, temporary encampments perhaps collapsing the two. This forced preservation has always necessitated technological enablement. The border, once a line in the sand made cartographic, then required barbed wire and today resurrects the border wall. As a politics, the wall, the political wall, invariably requires more than the cement to maintain its political aims. It always requires more than just the cement, bigger, higher, longer, thicker, wider. But more than that, it requires supplementation, the supplementation of policing, of a militarized policing. It requires oversight by forces, right? It used to be planes, it's now drones. It requires sort of the underneath, the kind of surveillance of the underneath, which once used to be digging out tunnels, but is now censored. A more cemented politics. Political wars are extended, irresolute technologies of civil warring, not their resolution. I mean, you can see, in a sense, the wall along the top always requires more. It always requires these police cars. It, as we'll see, will divide. There are, in fact, a land grab, a form of imperial state warring, not their resolution. A form of imperial state imposition. They colonize not just the land on which they are erected, nor only on either side or at either end. There are, in effect, colonizations of the landscape. You see this most effectively in the apartheid wall between Israel and Gaza, the West Bank. But you see it in walls that are, in walls that have been, as you know, in Berlin, and no doubt in walls to come, to be paid with the lives and the treasury of others. There are, in effect, colonizations of this landscape. There are orderings of the contours of the visible, of the lived, of ontic community, and the denials marking its constituting being and way of life. Fortress Europe is one version of this. Political wars are racial by conception, design, and implementation. In being about the lives of others, they are invariably about ourselves too. The homogeneity affected with political walling is purchased at the cost of lives interrupted and disrupted. Racial consideration, indeed determination, accordingly is at work here definitively. Race provides the brush painting the line between the belonging and the unbelonging. It colors those very characterizations. Racial characterization, or more forcefully determination, color codes the constitutively belonging from the unbelonging. It baptizes the legitimately born within from the coming from without, the pure from the so-called polluting, the nominally trusted from projected threat. So you get this, which is part of an opera called Hadestown by the Canadian opera composer Nais Mitchell, about why we build the wall. My children, we build the wall to keep out the enemy. The enemy is poverty. My children, my children. For racial states, enemies like poverty are always racially defined, of course. Enmity is inscribed in and on the racially conceived. On contoured and conscripted bodies, deemed threatening for whom, for which, the architecture of walling is a racially composed technology of circumscription and excision. Recent expressions of this racial politics of civil warring proliferate. There's a viscerality to racism today. Call this outbreak or outburst racism. No longer is it straightforwardly tethered, as I said, to state classificatory systems. People now declare whatever is on their mind, then deny it is racism. I had no intention. The accused blames the accuser for seeing racism where there is claimed to be none. No intention, no racism. Ahistoricity. The offense is the offenders, offenders, not the offenders. So consider a few cases, and I'm going to scroll through a couple of cases here. So Britain is full up of whom, of what? Full up of the same looking folks, right? No one more to be allowed in, no one from the outside, no one from other places, no one who's not looking like these folks, right? And then you get the second sort of case having to do with Dutch, Danish, German culture. Not long ago, as I said, it was more explicitly blood. Such culture is under threat, is being eroded, attacked, swamped, will disappear if we don't do something to stem the tide. And you'll notice, I mean, this, of course, is Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, sort of dressed up as the high priest of the condition. But Steve King is a congressman from the Midwest of the United States. And that statement by King, that Wilders understands the culture and demographics, that culture and the demographics are our destiny, we can only reproduce this through our own babies, right, is exactly that relational condition. Europeanity, you might say, that is at work in cases like this. Trump's campaign insistence that he would drain the swamp, right, is another version of this. It had nothing to do with ridding DC politics of corruption, quite the contrary. Swamps are ecologies of crocodiles, snakes, poisonous plants, and vermin, among other things. The swamp, politically, is his metaphor for race. It's racial reanimalization. And animalization, of course, has a long tropic history, in relation to the racial. Draining the Trumpian swamp is the undertaking to sweep out of DC Obama heterogeneity. It's about the only thing in which he has been true to his world. So again, I mean, all these guys are lookalikes, right? There's a version of this where a clever artist has replaced all the heads next to and behind Trump by this guy's face. So all these faces get to be the same guy, right? And quite literally, you have to really squeeze it in order to realize that it's, you know, the same person just replacing all of these folks. In his 100th day rally speech 10 days ago, Trump read a poem, The Snake, as a metaphor for crime-ridden illegal immigration. The snake has a long racial history. The sophomoric poem, however, has less to do with immigration than with sexual innuendo. A woman runs across a snake lying dying in the road. She picks it up, revives it. She strokes the snake, right, and bringing it back to life, and then, of course, the snake bites her. So it has less to do with immigration than with sexual innuendo, perhaps better characterizing Trump himself than the people he was seeking once again to malign. In France, identity génération identitaire, right, which is a development, a contemporary development, almost a social movement that develops out of the identity soup campaign from 2006. So in 2006, a street kitchen was providing food on the streets of Paris, and they ran out of beef with which they made the soup, and made the soup with pork, and they realized that two kinds of people weren't showing up to eat the soup that had previously been showing up to eat it, and they were, of course, Muslims and Jews. So in order to make a point that Europe is about white Catholicism and should exclude everybody else, they continued to make the soup with pork rather than going back to beef in order to exclude feeding those they had hitherto fed. This group that emerges out of that explicitly call for a Muslim-free France. Les Cités turned into a purging, a purification project. But it's a commitment to purging not all religious culture, only that not conforming to the secularized identification of Europe as white Catholic in its founding. And so images like this have begun to proliferate. Indeed, this campaign in the name of Hagia Sophia, right, taking up that very image, once a Greek Orthodox church, then becoming a Muslim mosque, and then redeveloped more contemporarily as a cultural museum. So you see the kind of heterogeneities of complex interactive engagements with each other that are then taken up by the likes of stopping Islamification, this in Antwerp, but across vast spans of Europe, you are in which the spires of the mosque, right, are taken to squeeze in the church cathedral that stands for the European. In Europe too, notably in Germany, eco-fascism, so you get this kind of image, reaches for environmentally friendly policies, but in the name of the sanctity of the fatherland, of reclaiming the unpolluted purity of the soil as national treasure. Here the imperative is for the land itself, the home of the body politic, to be guarded against foreign invasion that is seen to carry disease, germs, vermin, and pollutants in the name of that gesture. In the Netherlands, UK, the US, there's a claim that women's rights and homosexuality will not be respected by Muslim presence as though they fully are now, right? And so you get, again, this kind of relationality between the US and Europe, between Milo Yiannopoulos, the bad boy of the former bad boy, I guess, of the Republican Party, right, who at the Republican convention held the most fabulous party of all, at which Geert Wilders spoke. And the relation between Yiannopoulos's advocacy for paedophilia, sort of represented at the borderline in the background, and Wilders sort of speaking in front of it in the name of holding up these rights for everybody at, of all places, the Republican Party, which is squeezing out the very rights for which they're speaking, is peculiar, to say the least. Jews, of course, across Europe in various places. Umeå, Sweden's Jewish Community Center was closed down because of the severity of neo-Nazi threats, the France supermarket attacks and so on. So you get the Je suis Charlie campaign and so on, where religious militarization gets transformed in the name of liberty, equality, fraternity into a sort of religious nationalism. And excuse this picture, you'll know it somewhat, but this, of course, the Minister of Culture in Sweden opening an exhibition in which a black artist, in order to make a point, I mean, the very irony of this in the horror of the comic sort of gets inscribed in cutting up this black body, right? And then in the US, this is a CNN program about a month ago. The claims to colorblindness, literally not seeing race, in fact, amount to refusing, not seeing, ignoring the everyday conditions faced by black folk. Jeffrey Lord, the vocal CNN Trumpitarian in the far right corner, the sort of ghostly figure, you might say, compared Trump on threatening to withhold health care from the poor to get Democrats to negotiate with him about repealing and replacing Obamacare. He compared Trump in this campaign to Martin Luther King on getting people into the street to effect rights for blacks. When confronted on air by three African-American analysts, the three folks on your left, about the offensiveness of the analogy, he persistently denied he was being racially insensitive. But defense was not enough. racial offensiveness requires going on the offense. So he charged his critics for being racist, for refusing to be colorblind towards him, seeing him only as white. You have to admit he does have a kind of ghostly and ghastly quality, so it's hard to see him as anything but, right? Post-raciality is the denial, as Berndt was saying, and the denial of racial claims, and the recourse to racial reversals. So again, these are images. The one, of course, is a recent Svarte Piet image. The other, I think about 8 years ago, from the Swiss political campaign. And the recourse to racial reversals. This is a textbook case of white centrism. The refusal by Lord, what better name to have for my argument, to see that the daily life of those different from him is ordered in racial terms. That everyday racism means facing daily abusive, degrading, humiliating experiences. But it is also a case, relatedly, of white arrogance, insisting that the only terms of characterization are his. I mean, if you look at the dispositions of the three black folk in that image, right? The white woman was silent throughout. She was so put off by Lord's sort of intervention that she was literally speechless, right? But give it a break kind of look of the other folk, right? Whiteness operates constitutively as offense in the sense of both being offensive and being unqualifiedly, limitlessly on the offense in denial. Whiteness, not all white people, right, of course. This is a condition of racial militarization, of race as weapon, no backing down, taking no prisoners, weaponizing race. While scrubbing one's terms of explicitly racial characterization. So there's nothing for critics to point to. The smoking gun is always camouflaged in the paper bag of ignorance. In the US, recent studies have shown a significant correlation between those fearing diversity demographically and votes for Donald Trump. It was not that those who feared diversity voted for Trump, it was largely that those who voted for Trump feared diversity. This fear is of what diversity stands for or represents as lived condition, as a social future, what diversity supposedly or imaginatively entails. That fear, more than class considerations like loss of jobs or globalization, accounts for the late Trump surge in the election. Hardly natural, that fear was drummed up, helped along, shaped, exacerbated by a digital algorithmic campaign. That is, by exactly the techno forces of globalization the Trumpeterians so vocally dismissed. This fear-mongering has been quite common in the post-colonial era. Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech in 1968 Britain. George H.W. Bush's Willie Horton moment of the revolving black criminal, the rapist, right? Sarkozy in his successful French presidential election. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands across the past decade. Brexitania, Le Penisme, etc., etc. Post-raciality is not the end of race, let alone racism. The force of the post-racial today lies not in the claim to be beyond race, even in its aspirational sense. Rather, it is a subterfuge of afterthought in the name of which the most violent and vile forms of racism are being recharged. The post-racial, it turns out, is but the contemporary modality of racism's renewal and virality. License is given as a consequence for those who are inclined to express themselves publicly in blatantly racist ways with far less consequence than in the immediately post-civil rights era past. These expressions can take the form of words and deeds, sometimes with physical, invariably with expressive violence. They obviously debilitate those at whom these expressions of violence are aimed, usually those in more vulnerable positions than the perpetrators. But in doing so, they debilitate, delimit society at large. In Trumpeterian America today, fear of heterogeneity is articulated explicitly regarding African Americans. Black Lives Matter, Trump says, jobless because they have, quote unquote, tattoos on their foreheads. Sorry, O'Reilly, not Trump, but Trump could have said it. They have tattoos on their foreheads. Latinos, Mexicans, this is Trump, bad hombres, murderers, rapists, criminals, almost all. Muslims are terrorists. In Europe, this fear is largely expressed about the latter. Terrorists, Muslims, pushed, you've just had a case or set of cases here, right? Pushed along by the collapsing universalization of color, culture, and character. It's not just refugees and migrants, but refugees and migrants ethno-racially presupposed, religious identification hardened into universalizing racial narration, absent the explicit terms of racial identification. So you get this. Raciality, as I said earlier, secularizes the religious. In doing so, it offers simultaneously the targeting of the religious under the cover of racial intimation, absent explicit racial reference, a 500-year history. Racial fabrication never quite fit the facts on the ground. Like polluting air, religious raciality knows no cartographic borders. Racialities are floating signifiers, so to speak, as much seeping into us as about us. They are as much a product of historical, our historical, which is to say also compulsively obsessive imperial colonial seepages as of contemporary geopolitics. Again, you see the kind of tropes of religiosity and crusader sort of activity at work. Heterogeneities are messy, uncontainable. It's what makes them so attractive and open to attack by those threatened by their promiscuity. In the US today, Berkeley, home of the free speech movement, neighbor to the Black Panthers, where ethnic studies were born, is ground zero for America's Civil War, where Antifa folks, anti-fascist and anarchistic activists, defend against violent invasion by outright white supremacists. The imperative, the command, the drive, the imposition of a politics of homogenization is fueled out of the fear of the proverbial black-brown planet. It is the defense of white world, its privileges and powers against invading barbarians out to decivilize society. In announcing the bombing of Syria Air Force Base in April, in the wake of the chemical attack by Assad, Trump did so explicitly in the name of calling on all civilized nations of the world. Marine Le Pen characterized the French presidential election as a choice about civilization. So chemical weapons are uncivilized. Cluster or barrel or the mother or mother effer of all bombs are not. Anonymous drone drops on unsuspecting weddings operated from 10,000 miles away represent civilization on the scorecard. After all, on this calculus, 5,000 feet is the best, a characterization of drone warfare. Civil wars in the end are conflicts over the contours and coloring, the quality and character of civil and social life, and over the levers of state as their embodiment. Like war more generally, civil wars are struggles to the death or to subjugating surrender for fear of death, whether of life or what one stands for. They are wars over the very fabric of being in the social world, over the condition of state control, over what counts as civility. Civility is the inheritance of ways of being and doing in a society, sedimenting into set ways taken as given, as natural. These ways, the inheritance of modernizing state making, are racially ordered all the way up and down. Violations or transgressions are taken as attacks on ways of life, on the life world itself. These life worlds, I have been insisting, are racially constituted and comprehended. The breached wall is to be plastered up, cemented with the mud and blood of reinvented racialities against invasion and claimed pollution of the invented tradition. Trumpitarianism represents the latest version of this homogenizing parochialism. Yes, that is a made-up notion to signify a newly made-up iteration of this reinvented raciality. It references, if not fully incorporating, also the kind of Brexiteering, the kind of the French anticipation, the kind of Franticipation, the world of whining, the Putinisme, the Netanyahuing, the Assadification, all of which have their own, if related, versions of race making. the social unsettlements of neoliberalizing globalization, the related heterogeneities that have proliferated, the license to say and almost do anything about and to the projected non-belonging, no matter how offensive and violent, and the licensing and release of authoritarianisms, large and petty, as a response. The repeat into a walling off solipsism can only come with and as violence generalized to the social condition writ large. The violence is as much hermeneutical as material. Homogenization as process in politics is possible in birth and beyond only with the force, the violence of repression. Airports, as Taiyo Selassie hints at in her beautifully insightful and searingly rendered essay, exemplify between states par excellence in the age of rampant globalization and financialization of everything. The byways of mixture, of super intersectionalities, of mixed upness. Please. Our post-sovereign Tower of Babel, technically outside of jurisdictionality, outside, beyond the law, their indefinability shored up, cemented, walled into hyper-securitization. In principle, outside of state sovereignty, one has passed out of the departed state, not yet entering the destination. Airports are remade as sites of absolutized authority. They are completely walled in sites, here advanced by computational databases of the algorithmic state. Identity, to use Nishant Shah's terms, is metamorphosed into identification. Biopower has been subsumed into biometric power. Airports are the laboratories for the power of sovereignty in the face of its challenge. We, travelers and airport workers alike, are always just passing through. But the passage is also a freezing in time into shared states of both suboptimality and hyper-competitiveness. For seats, for space, for resources, for air. We are here always, hypersensitively, at others' behest. The sovereigns and the mini-sovereigns, the petty authoritarians, the Trumpitarians, most of all. Racial identification is squeezed betwixt and between these heightened contestations, the airline sort of fights, heightening the pulse, cover for the opacity of selfhood, denuding the personal, all ever under suspicion, just some a whole lot more than others. Always on the verge of losing control, of being pulled from the line or from one's seat, demanding one's password to the private. Airports are the only openly public spaces where being reduced to nakedness can be generally commanded or enforced, where bearing and bearing blackness is once again made into a generalized security project for all, awkwardly, discomfortingly to witness in the flesh. Nearing the end. When we say Black Lives Matter, it is imperative to recognize this relationally and not simply or only oppositionally. Oppositionally, it immediately affects the inevitable reaction, all lives matter, blue lives matter, identity optimality parading as universalism. This may surface the concern at work, but it more likely reifies the warring, even as it might well legitimate the accusation which heightens the danger of devolving into finger-pointing, moralizing, even extended violence against the targeted rather than effective political action and outcomes. Relationally, it is crucial to get people to comprehend that all lives won't matter until black lives, all black lives, lives recognized in and for their blackness, really do. Identity optimality is a racial governance project. For blue lives to matter, black lives must equally and be recognized as such, not least by blue lives, and more generally, by all. Where optimality is not a racial operation, but dignified lives without walls. Where the thoughtless devolution into civil war is not just not a strategic option. It is unthinkable, inconceivable, no option at all. Street protests and petitions are important, given time and place. At their best and biggest, they indicate both the depth and breadth of the political concern. They configure, indeed remake, by repurposing both the publicness of the state, street square, in which the gathering takes place, and the heterogeneous public itself as contesting body, as Judith Butler has noted. But they really do give in to a one-timeness, an eventfulness. A picture recently went viral. I'm sure you've all seen this, particularly the one on your right, of a young woman, Sophia Khan, casually dressed within a half arm's length of a Keep Britain White agitator. He was decked in the black English Defence League sports shirt, so politics is sport, at a small EDL street march in Birmingham, Britain's most diverse city. She had stepped forward to support another woman surrounded by menacing white guys yelling insults. How too usual is that? Women are not only surrounded by thieving, sexually harassing refugees, as is too often assumed and charged. Harassment is unacceptable, no matter the perpetrator. Khan's EDL interlocutor looks to be protesting, screaming at her very existence, her being in Britain. He is asserting the street as exclusively white space. She is half smiling at him, hands deep in her pockets, quietly exuding confidence, amused at his foolishness. In that bemused smile and stance, she is conveying how utterly idiotic he is acting. The problem is all yours, she seems to be saying. Her calm dignity and quiet self-assertion convey the sense that she fully belongs on the street, lives in and is of the city, of this, her world. In contrast to the violent, shouting, red-faced crusaders, suburban outsiders invading the center city in the name of keeping outsiders out. Take a deep breath, she is signaling. Calm down, assume civility. And then perhaps I can tell you a bit about who we are, what we bring to this place and space, how we make it, and you, better than you otherwise are. The EDL men clearly delimit, circumscribe, make smaller. Sophia Khan, in her very being, in her presence, enlarges the polity, opens it up, makes of it not thoughtlessly parochial, but capaciously worldly. She can talk authoritatively about their world. They are completely clueless about hers. This in turn reveals the necessity and range of the coalitions at work, the most effective large-scale anti-racist movements, abolition, anti-colonial, civil rights, anti-apartheid, now Black Lives Matter, have been cross-racial, multi-gendered, multi-generational, cross-class, local and global. Intersectional, all wonderfully and wondrously mixed up. The leadership has been mixed, ever mindful of the concerns of constituencies represented by other than their own. They have to be open, inviting, exciting, multiplicitous, heterogeneous, not shutting down by shutting up or shutting out. But then this has to translate into concrete developments, visible transformations of the commonplace to the greater equality and betterment of all, not just one-time events. All lives matter only when every life really does, when no one is picked out, targeted, ignored, foreclosed, precluded, shut out, to use Coetzee's term, prematurely killed or left to die because ethno-racially serialized. Not when all lives signal the violent, refusing, repressive, erasing, annihilating negation of some for the sake of perpetuating a racially sterile, a color blind, a veil of ignorance, social and economic status quo. Again, you get this as a contemporary instance of that expression. Only when the all no longer artificially reduces its universalism to the chosen of one national deity or another by walling itself within the borders of this or that ethno-racially presupposed turf or territory, neighborhood or nation. Only such conditions will weaponizing give way to nonviolence, racial militarization to demilitarizing the social, profiling to co-constituting world-making, humiliation to humility and dignity. Oops, sorry, lost that image. The intensities and suspicions of perpetual civil war only then will make way for open civility, dignified sociality, interactive co-constitution, and politico-economic equality. Thank you.